From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the State House passes bills taking on sexual abuse on two fronts, criminal,
holding accountable the perpetrator and bringing him to justice and behind bars, and from a civil side, you have the ability to make sure that we're there for survivors, and we're expanding the statute of limitations to allow them justice.
State Attorney General Bill Schuette wants to be your next governor.
We need to win and compete with the economic climate of more jobs and bigger paychecks. And my jobs and paychecks agenda is all about growing our population.
And President Trump wants a tariff on foreign cars, trucks, and parts.
The impact of this, if it were to happen, and that's a really important caveat here, could be profound on the industry and on trade flows.
And the village whose roads are so bad they're wondering if they'll wind up going back to gravel. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More than two dozen bills in response to sexual predator Larry Nassar are moving from a State House committee to the full House and then back over to the Senate today. Nassar, of course, is the former Michigan State University sports doctor who will likely spend the rest of his life in prison for sexually assaulting his patients. Here with us now is Republican Representative Clint Casto, chair of the State House Law and Justice Committee. He's been leading the negotiations in the House over these bills. Representative, let's start with the statute of limitations. You've extended the statute of limitations for future victims. You've gone from age 21 years in the Senate bill to 28 years old. Why?
On the criminal side, here's what we did. On the criminal, Senate Bill 871, we went from 10-year statute of limitations to 15 years. If you were an adult, it's 15 years from whenever the incident happens. If you're a minor, then it's 28 years old or 15 years from when it happened, whichever is later. Now, that's the criminal side. So we're improving our criminal statute of limitations, making sure that prosecutors and law enforcement have the tools to be able to hold accountable and bring to justice those perpetrators. On the civil side, that's 872. What we did was take it from 2 to 3 years or 1 year after you become the age of majority, so 19 if you were a minor, to 10 years or 10 years from when you become the age of majority. So if you were a child and you were abused and sexually assaulted, you have until the age of 28. And if you were an adult, you have 10 years from whenever it happened. So we put that in line with looking at policy, looking at what other states did, and then talking to experts and talking to advocacy groups. We talked to the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence, and they were all in support of these two bills. So from a statute of limitations program, statute of limitations view, you have an increase for more holding accountable the perpetrator and bringing him to justice and behind bars. And from a civil side, you have the ability to make sure that we're there for survivors, and we're expanding the statute of limitations to allow them justice to be able to have their civil remedy.
And this is for future victims. Now, I want to look at retroactive lawsuits for abuse going back to 1997. The House has tightened up the Senate bill by only allowing cases involving physicians who try to pass off assault as medical treatment, which seems tailor-made for Nassar survivors. How about victims of coaches, teachers, Roman Catholic priests? Why don't they get the same chance to retroactively file a suit?
You know, those are a little bit different, and here's why. Because, first off, we had 12 people on the committee, and all the retroactivity piece was put in question as a matter of policy as to what to do. Initially, there wasn't any support, really, minimal support, I should say, for the retroactivity piece. And that's the process of looking at the committee and deliberating and answering questions and asking questions about why and what purpose the statute of limitations serve, and what about retroactivity? And retroactivity is a tricky topic, because why should there be, or why shouldn't there be, or were the statutes in place as law, weren't they constitutional? And they were. And there are some questions as to the constitutionality. There are some cases that say retroactivity on civil claims are okay. Some are indirect at that. But here's the bottom line. When you look at the situation with Larry Nassar, we heard from one of the survivors, and she indicated that she was conditioned and she was essentially brainwashed to believe that what was happening was a medical condition. She had questions about what actually was happening, but based on conversations with others, they conditioned her, and Larry Nassar conditioned her to believe that this is medical treatment. So when we're looking at retroactivity, we said, wait a minute, We are including a tolling prospectively, which means this, that we put in a provision that when you find out that a sexual assault occurred, you have 3 years from that time, even if it's beyond the statute of limitations, to bring forth a claim. So we tried to take that because of the medical scenario. So that's how we looked at the retroactive part that says, as a matter of fairness to somebody who would have been conditioned, would have been brainwashed to believe that this was a medical treatment, an avenue for a recourse in the civil justice system should be there. And that's how we ended up with that.
Representative Kessel, let's pivot over to mandatory reporting, which would legally require certain people to report suspected instances of sexual assault or abuse. To whom exactly? What's in your bill? Who would they report it to?
Well, how it works, actually, it's not reporting instances of sexual abuse per se. It's what it is reporting instances of child abuse and neglect. Under the law right now, the intent of it is that teachers, health professionals, doctors, individuals that have a professional capacity who are able to identify child abuse and neglect will call up the Department of Health and Human Services and Child Protective Services, say, look, whoever's the guardian or parent, there's something wrong here. There's some type of abuse. Go look into it. And under the law, that includes reporting about the following. Reporting about parents or guardians, teachers, teachers' aid, clergy, and what the way that is a little vague in the language is people who have the welfare, health and welfare of the child, and then it goes into teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So the intent is those people who are really monitoring those kids or really close to those kids and taking responsibility for them.
Who are mandatory reporters then under your new bills?
Essentially, we include individuals of a professional capacity that would interact with children. Many of the individuals have a license under the license and regulatory affairs. So let's say physician's assistants, teachers, healthcare professionals. And what we added was physical therapists, and we also added athletic trainers because they are licensed under law. That's just a few. There's mm-hmm. clergy in there.
How about paid coaches?
Paid coaches are not in there.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's difficult having a blanket law for paid coaches. I mean, where is the line drawn? Is it the Little League coach that makes $20 for just organizing the event? Or is it university coaches? And then, what are they actually reporting about? Because the Larry Nassar situation, I don't think, fits under this one. You don't call Child Protective Services that investigate the abuse by parents and guardians when it's a Larry Nassar, a physician, who's sexually assaulting them from their time as athletes. So it didn't fit in there. So here's what we did. We looked at another section. We said if the coach is there and they're dismissing and trying to brush off what someone is telling them, hey, Larry Nassar is sexually assaulting me, dissuading them from reporting. No, don't report. This is going to be bad for you. It's going to be bad for the program. Nothing's going to come about it. Then we make that a crime and a penalty. Because under the other statute, it would be unclear whether or not there would be criminal responsibility or sanctions.
Could this not lead us into a he said, she said situation? I'm wondering, would it not be clearer to frame it under mandatory reporting? The person was told of the abuse, the person is a mandatory reporter, so either they reported it or didn't, end of story. By having the using a position of authority to prevent reporting of abuse, does that get into that someone could say, well, I was giving her advice as a friend that she could lose her scholarship, that kind of he said, she said?
No, I don't think it does. And, you know, we have to stop looking at the legislator to say, let's make laws for people to do the right thing. You know, it is unfortunate that people don't, but we got to come together as a society. I mean, where are we going to draw the line from people doing the right thing? This coach at MSU, she's being told that the girls are being sexually assaulted, and she doesn't do anything. The Title IX people, they knew what was going on. They know what Larry Nassar was doing. They even said that we wouldn't have done it like this, but you know what? We think we'll give them a deference that this is medical treatment. Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Come on, folks. Let's get real here. When you see something wrong, enough is enough. Go to the authorities. Report it. Do something. We don't need laws to teach people to do the right thing. We need parents. We need teachers. We need good role models. And you can't legislate that, Cynthia.
You know, it was reported, Representative Kessel, that bills getting rid of governmental immunity in certain sexual misconduct cases didn't clear the committee. You said there wasn't enough support to move them. Why was that?
Because it puts taxpayers on the hook. That's why. Now, if there's intentional acts, you can make a civil claim. The governmental immunity doesn't preclude that. If there's gross negligence, you can make civil claims. But for your common negligence to say that somebody was negligent, so now all the taxpayers of the state of Michigan are going to be on the hook through the budget, there wasn't support for that. And frankly, when I talk to people, my constituents and the people in the state of Michigan, they said, no, we shouldn't be responsible for someone else's intentional actions. So based on that, based on other testimony that came through committee, there wasn't support for that piece of legislation.
Commerce Township GOP Representative Clint Casto, Chair of the House Law and Justice Committee, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Yesterday, Michigan Radio's longtime senior news analyst Jack Lessenberry announced he was stepping down. The resignation comes after a May 17th story in Deadline Detroit entitled Jack Lessenberry's Long History of Questionable Behavior with Women. The allegations in the article date back decades. They come from women who worked with Lessenberry and students he taught at Wayne State University. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reported that one accusation includes inappropriate physical contact. The others cite inappropriate remarks. Throughout all of this, Lessenberry has maintained he did nothing wrong. In a statement to Michigan Radio, he said, and I quote, "I am saddened by the events of the last several days and admit to absolutely no wrongdoing whatsoever." But there are still unanswered questions. Among them are, why did Michigan Radio wait until yesterday to part ways with Jack Lessenberry when the article came out on May 17th? The article in Deadline Detroit makes clear that rumors about Lessenberry's behavior were known among Wayne State students for years. How long has management known there might be concerns about his behavior and what action, if any, was taken? These are just a couple of the unanswered questions we had. As we do on Stateside, anytime significant news stories occur, we attempt to cover it. To that effort, this morning, our executive producer, Joe Lindstroth, emailed a written request to Michigan Radio's communications director to interview someone from senior management for today's show. That request was denied. Instead, station management sent us this statement, and I quote, "Like many of you, we recently learned of allegations of inappropriate behavior against Jack in his role as a Wayne State University professor. As a result of these allegations, Wayne State has begun an independent investigation into the accusations. Although Jack has denied any wrongdoing, he offered his resignation yesterday to, in his words, avoid distracting listeners from the fine work of Michigan Radio." The statement continues, "We appreciate the trust that listeners and donors place in Michigan Radio, and personal and organizational integrity is an important part of that trust. While we are not aware of any complaints against Jack from our staff, Michigan Radio is committed to a workplace free of offensive or demeaning behavior, and we take all reports of misconduct seriously. We wish Jack..." You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump is considering tariffs on imported cars, trucks, and parts. That word came after a Wednesday morning tweet from the president promising, quoting here, "Big news coming soon for our great American auto workers. After many decades of losing your jobs to other countries, you have waited long enough." Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. The president ordered the Commerce Department to investigate whether imported cars and trucks are a threat to national security. What is in this argument that they're a threat to national security?
I'm not sure. What I can tell you is that the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans and the Iranians don't import any cars in the United States. So our geopolitical adversaries apparently are not damaging or threatening to national security, that our allies are. That's, I think you have to start with there to understand it. You know, I don't know where this is going to go. I know that the industry was a bit surprised by this. CEOs were in to see the president a couple of weeks ago, and he made, apparently, from what I understand from people who were in the room, basically had two messages. One, build more cars in the United States. Number two, you import too many. And he apparently, there was one CEO, I think from a German company, who protested a little bit and said, well, my company builds X numbers of cars in the United States. And he says, yeah, well, you import Y number, which was even more. And apparently the president was right and really rocked these guys back on their heels. And apparently it was pretty hard on the Germans. So that was kind of the warm up to this. So I think they saw that something like this was going to be coming. But the impact of this, if it were to happen, and that's a really important caveat here, could be profound on the industry and on trade flows.
All right, explain why. I guess, do we start with the supply chain? Or where do we start?
I mean, I don't know where to start, to be honest
so
with you.
So it's that big.
I mean, it's globally integrated supply chain. You have products that's flowing back and forth across the border. In some cases, vehicles and parts could cross the U.S.-Mexico border 3, 4, 5 times before it actually is shipped for commerce. And all that has profound impact on cost. One of the big drivers here, one of the big questions is, what is this going to ultimately cost the consumer? That's one question. The other question is, he's writing about how this is going to benefit auto workers. Well, really, where? Which auto workers? Would it be the Toyota workers in Texas? Would it be the Nissan workers in Tennessee? The people in Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina and Indiana and Kentucky? Just go down the list and guess what? Almost every one of those states were Trump states.
Mm-hmm.
The implications for some of these companies, and by the way, you don't change your production and all of a sudden source all your products overnight. This is a years-long process in terms of moving production around, deciding what you're going to do. Now, there is a history of tariffs on foreign pickups in the United States, which is a key reason, by the way, that Toyota builds its full-size pickup in Texas, and Nissan builds it in, I think it's Mississippi. Because of the tariffs. There is a 25% tariff on foreign-made pickup trucks that come into the United States. So do tariffs work? They can. They can change behavior in an industry. I don't think there's any question about that. But there's a real lag time there, and they don't necessarily benefit the people that he thinks they would benefit.
Well, here he is saying good news for our American auto workers. I'm just wondering, how much do you think this has to do with politics in Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Pennsylvania, looking ahead to the midterms?
Well, I think it does, but I think my point, my rejoinder back is, which American auto workers are we talking about? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about UAW members in Michigan, or are we talking about non-union auto workers predominantly in the South, who, by the way, they vote too.
And they're the states that put them in the White House.
And they're Americans too. Mm-hmm. This is the thing that I think is so inane about this whole discussion. It's essentially pitting one group of auto workers against the other. And I don't think you necessarily know where where you stand and how this benefits. I think we're going to hear a little bit today from the president of the UAW, which may give us a sense about their reading on this. I mean, on one hand, they've got a guy in the White House who seems to be singing some of their songs, as it were. But I'm not sure that they want to cozy up to him in terms of policy.
And what could this mean in the ongoing talks to tweak and overhaul NAFTA?
Well, there's a school of thought that that's what this is all about. I talked to somebody in Washington yesterday who said some of their intel was that Canada and Mexico would not be exempt from this. Now, there's an awful lot of product that is sold in the United States that is built in Canada and Mexico, and Canada and Mexico are also markets for U.S. products. So if they're not exempt, then what does that mean? That essentially means the United States goes into this kind of fortress mentality in terms of product. And trust me, I think the pushback on this is going to be furious. It's going to be from the automakers. It's going to be from foreign dealers. Dealer bodies are very powerful and probably predominantly Republican around the country. You're going to have cities, states, it's just not going to be an easy thing. And it's not going to happen overnight. These things sometimes take up to a year, as I understand these investigations. It's not something that they do in 4 weeks.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
All across Michigan, cities, towns, villages are struggling with how to provide basic services in light of shrinking revenue sharing from the state and taxation restrictions imposed by the Headley Amendment. Basic services like maintaining the roads. The village of Brooklyn in Jackson County is a good example of this struggle, where roads are in such bad shape, some in city government talk about maybe taking them back to gravel. With us now are Brooklyn Village Manager Jay Gutschow and Village Trustee Stella Roberts. It's great to have you both with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thank you.
Jay, how many miles of roads do you have in Brooklyn?
Just under 9 miles.
So just under 9 miles. And Stella, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being pristine and perfect, 10 being atrocious and potholed, where would you rank the state of roads in Brooklyn?
Well, we certainly have some that are a 10. We have a lot of them that are middle of the road, five, six, seven. I don't think at this point we really have any that are rated number one. We might have a two somewhere.
Jay, would you concur with that?
I would. There, you know, overall, I think we're probably at an eight level overall, which is on the verge of being totally rebuilt.
Okay, so sliding down to that atrocious scale of 10, if not already there. So, Jay, help us understand how this came to be. What's the financial situation that's left Brooklyn without the money to get these roads back up to a one?
Well, a lot of it's related to being a cumulative effect, and you've alluded to the Headley Amendment that occurred in 1978. Prior to that, and for probably a couple of decades, the village has had a dedicated street millage of 5 mills. So up until 1978, 5 mills was collected in as far as tax revenue goes. Once the Headley Amendment was approved, it gradually whittled away at our millage rate. So at the present time, our street millage is 3.55 mills. So the cumulative effect, and I don't know what the total amount is from 1978, but the cumulative effect from 1978 to present is that we aren't accumulating enough revenue to be able to maintain the roads on an annual basis. Coupled with that, the state revenue sharing has been whittled away by the legislature over the course of time as well. Just as an example, since 2002, there's over $400,000 that has not come from Lansing to the village of Brooklyn for the streets.
So your money is being throttled off.
Exactly.
And if you're thinking dollars and cents, broadly speaking then, how much do you see, Jay, that it would cost to get these roads moved back up to what everybody would agree would be a good level? Not just patching, but repairing.
Right. We are in the process of evaluating the condition and getting current pricing on that. My latest estimate has been approximately $800,000 for our roughly 9 miles of streets in the village to get them back to what you would consider an acceptable condition. That's the whole range of doing anything from crack sealing to a total rebuild, depending on the current condition of those roads. Then you're talking about, you know, annual maintenance budget perpetually that I have estimated in the neighborhood of $150,000 a year.
And how much money's in the kitty? First, as far as repairs, and then when you say that $150,000, what money do you have now?
Well, we're in the process of looking at the budget for the next year. I'm looking at probably less than $100,000, really, that would be available for those kinds of reconstruction rebuilds. That's not counting what we have for day-to-day maintenance, which includes anything from filling potholes to plowing snow. Obviously, we have to be able to do those day-to-day services in addition to the major rebuilding of the streets.
So here you have only about an eighth of what you need to get these roads repaired. Stella, what about asking voters to approve a special millage?
Well, we went that route 2 years ago, and we asked to have the Headley override, and the voters denied our request soundly. And some of our village council members think that if they're not willing to do this, then we need to look at other kinds of options of taking care of their roads, one comment of which was, well, we can just turn it back to a gravel road, which don't cost near that much to maintain. So that's how this kind of got started, and the article that was written in our local paper. I don't personally think that's the right way to go. I think we as a council need to be very creative and find some ways to support fixing our roads. We're kind of in the process of doing that, as Jay alluded to, with our budget for the next year. We're looking at all ideas and everything from raising taxes to I don't know what. We're open for any suggestions.
I can totally hear this kind of, I don't know, we're kind of handcuffed. You've got the reality of the Headley Amendment. You've got the declining revenue sharing. You had people that said, to approving a special millage. What kind of options does that really leave?
Well, one of the options that we have as a village council is we do not levy the maximum amount of mills we can for general operating. And we can levy some more millage and ear note that specifically for roads. And that's certainly the way I'm leaning. because that would get us the ability to not only fix them, but also maintain them. There's a couple of council members that are quite against that, and rightfully so. They have their opinions and their reasons, but I haven't seen a magic tree growing out in the village square that says, here's a check, fix your roads.
Jay, it strikes me that there's this tension that leaders like you at every level of municipalities and moving up into state government and even national, that we want services, but that word tax seems to just be kind of a bad three-letter word to so many people. Can't have one without the other, can you?
No, that's for sure. I mean, government is expensive. And what we see at the local level here, of course, is the backlash from the national political scene. You know, there's a lot of, obviously, negativism about the national government. That trickles down to our attitudes about state government. And certainly we're not exempt from that at the local level, too. So I understand when people say, well, we don't want to increase our taxes. We don't want to approve the Headley override to go back to what we had before 1978. But there are consequences to that as well. Something has to give in the way of services, or in this particular case, the condition of the streets. These things are not free. Many municipalities are experiencing the same thing, because even though you could see this problem developing perhaps decades ago, everyone kicks the can down the road, so to speak, hoping that somebody's going to come and bail them out, that somebody being state government. And it's pretty evident that that's not going to happen at the state or national level.
So you really have to pull your own selves up by the bootstraps, so to speak.
Absolutely. One of the things that has come out in the current federal administration was the ratio of funding for infrastructure. It used to be 80% federal and 20% state and local. The current administration has made it pretty clear that that ratio is now going to be 20% federal and 80% state and local.
When you heard that idea floated in council meeting about, well, how about gravel roads? What did you think, Jay?
Well, we can maintain the gravel roads because we have a large enough plow truck that we plow snow in the wintertime with. We can use the same equipment to grade the roads on a pretty regular basis if they are returned to gravel. There are different maintenance issues involved in that. You might have debris washing into the storm system, for instance, so that means we're going to have to clean that system out more frequently. So there's other things that are still going to be a cost, but certainly gravel roads are going to be cheaper to maintain than paved roads, but they're not cheaper on your vehicles. You are going to replace your tires and shock absorbers and have other issues because of gravel that you wouldn't have if you had paved roads.
Stella, is this a divisive issue in Brooklyn? I mean, what do you hear from people?
Well, I hear from the constituents of Brooklyn that they want the roads fixed. I don't think anybody really wants to go backwards in time to gravel roads. When I moved to Brooklyn in 1970, we had several gravel streets in town. And I know that one of the big complaints, of course, was the amount of dust and the amount of mud and all of those kinds of things. And when you become a more progressive community, you get rid of the gravel roads. So I don't think anybody really wants to go back there. I really, truly feel that the council is going to be able to come together and come up with a solution to do something. Is it going to be enough money to do everything we need to do? That I'm not sure, but I think we will make a good start into helping our road situation. And as you look around and talk to people in a social setting, the first thing everybody wants to talk about is, did you drive on such and such a road? It's in terrible shape. And it's not just our village of Brooklyn, it's the county of Jackson, it's the state of Michigan. And we have been looking at other communities to see what they have come up with as solutions, some of which are probably the same kind of things we're going to end up doing. It's just a universal problem.
Jay, how do you see this working out? What kind of solution do you think city leaders can come up with that the public will accept?
That's a good question. You know, that's something we've been debating for many months now. Anything they perceive as a tax increase is going to be unpopular. However, I think our current council is understanding that they may have to make these tough decisions and say, we're going to do this, because when I talk about doing this, talking about increasing the millage rate in the general fund and then rolling that over to the streets, because frankly, we need to be able to maintain the roads that we have that don't need to be completely rebuilt now, because in a year or two, we're going to be to a point where they're going to be more expensive to do a total rebuild on those. And the price of these improvements is not going to be any cheaper than it is today. It's going to be more expensive. So the problem is going to be exacerbated over time if we do nothing. So it's one of those things where we have to bite the bullet. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time apologizing in my role as a village manager already for a variety of things. We will have to just apologize to our constituents and say, this is the alternative. The bottom line for them, whether they want to pay for it or not, is it's going to cost them eventually anyway, whether it's in the maintenance of their vehicles or when it comes to selling their property. Local realtors have told me that on average, the poor condition of the roads will reduce the selling price of their properties by a minimum of $10,000. So they can pay $10,000 now or they can pay $10,000 later. There's still going to be a cost to them that they're going to see.
A view of the challenges of governing at a local level, as we've been speaking with Brooklyn Village Manager Jay Gutcho and Village Trustee Stella Roberts. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on board.
After the break, a conversation with State Attorney General Bill Schuette. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now with our series of conversations with the candidates who want to become your next governor. We've spoken with the Democrats who are running for their party's nomination. Now we turn to the GOP. With us now is State Attorney General Bill Schuette. Welcome. We appreciate this chance to hear your views.
Great to be with you, Cynthia. I've been looking forward to this and a pleasure to be on Stateside.
Great. Well, we're asking all of the candidates about a number of very important issues to Michigan. So let's just plunge right in.
I've been tuning in.
All right. Well, let's start with education, because by every measure, Michigan's average student test scores are going the wrong way. One example is that study that found Michigan's third grade reading scores are just about dead last of the 50 states. We're losing ground. How do we do better for our students?
Well, you know, the fact is that, as you correctly point out, Cynthia, that Michigan is at the bottom, ranks at the bottom of third grade reading scores. And what this means is that only 35% of our third graders are proficient in reading. And that's outrageous. People ought to be up in arms about this. The fact is that when you can't read, the future, the lens of through which you view Michigan or America is gloomy and dim. You know, this country has been described as a shining city on a hill. But if you can't read the directions to get there, or if you can't spell opportunity, what kind of life is that going to be? And so the fact that our reading scores are at the bottom of the heap to me means, okay, we need to have a more aggressive approach. And when I'm governor, Michigan's children will read.
And would you increase spending for students in order to get there, spending that's not tied to inflation?
You know, here's the real core on this. You know, I went to public schools. My wife and I went to Carpenter Street School, Jefferson Middle School, Midland Dow, and our children went to public schools as well. They had a great education. But for too many children, they're trapped in a system that's not working for them. And I think education policy needs to be, it's a four-letter word, spelled KIDS, K-I-D-S, where parents are in charge and parents and families make the decisions. I think we should do the following. We ought to grade our schools A through F. We need to have, secondly, incentive grants, performance grants, to reward those schools that are improving. When I'm governor, I will have a literacy director, a cabinet-level person smack dab in the governor's office, focusing just on reading. And I'll have a Michigan Reading Foundation where we can encourage the philanthropic community, the business community, to contribute to the Michigan Reading Foundation so we can have reading coaches in schools, summer reading camps, reading festivals. Again, and when I'm governor, Michigan's children will read, and parents have to be in charge on all of this.
What about those schools, as you say, we're going to grade schools, but what about those schools in impoverished areas that haven't been getting what the schools in the more affluent areas have been getting? Could we see a per pupil funding increase to help them out?
Well, if you look at these third grade reading scores, it's happening across the state. So it's irrespective of are you rural or urban, north, south, east, west. The fact is we need to have a frontal assault on education. And, you know, we need to have reading transportation scholarships so that if sometimes, you know, Cynthia, there might be a family that has a special need with one of their children. There may be a school that has a special program, but sometimes the transportation costs is the impediment prohibits getting from a family to a school. Reading transportation scholarships could help. Or maybe you're trapped in your neighborhood school isn't what you want, but you can't get to another one. So we need to try different ideas. The fact is that, and this is the difference between the Democrats and Bill Schuette, and the fact is they're just supporting the status quo. The status quo isn't working for enough families because our reading scores are at the bottom. So we need a change.
Let's go over to Rhodes. We're speaking of spending. Despite the increase in the gasoline tax, despite the higher registration fees, the roads aren't really getting better, and in much of the state, they're getting worse. What would you do if you're elected governor about our roads, our bridges, and our other infrastructure? How would you find the money we need to improve those?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Again, this is part of the difference between the Democrats and Republicans. And what Whitmer and the Democrats, their first instinct is to raise taxes. And what I'm going to do is just the opposite. Number one, we need to have more guarantees and warranties when we build roads and bridges and work with our infrastructure. Secondly, there needs to be a full, complete scrubbing of the review process of the Michigan Department of Transportation. By eliminating the prevailing wage statute, number three, there'll be another $250 million available for roads and bridges here in the state of Michigan. And those are the things we need to look at first. And, you know, the budget of Michigan is $56 billion. And so the fact is that we can't have priorities and dedicate continuous, consistent revenue stream just, you know, it just kind of boggles the imagination. When I go to roundtables with employers or employees, community leaders, two things always come up. It's cut auto insurance rates and what are you going to do to fix the roads? And the fact is we need to have a consistent revenue stream. And that's how we ought to approach it first.
And I know that you've been upfront about wanting a tax cut. Why is right now a good time to do that?
You know, I want Michigan to win again. I want Michigan to grow. Our biggest challenge, Cynthia, is population because other states are growing faster than we are. Yes, we've rebounded, but we're still 300,000 jobs short of where we were before the Great Recession of 2007 and 8. And the fact is, there are 55 counties in Michigan that have lost population in this decade. So that means that other states are growing faster than we are. And, you know, we used to have 19 members of Congress. We're going to have 13 members of Congress after this next census. And so it means that we're not winning enough. Other states are getting the Foxcoms and HQ2 and from Amazon, and we need to win. And I want us to compete and win against the Carolinas and the Texases and the Floridas where you see cranes in the sky and boots on the ground. We need to have an attitude that we're going to win again, and we need to rebuild our population. And that's really Michigan's key issue. And there is not one issue that wouldn't be minimized, lessened, or helped if we had more people in the state. So we need to build our population. That's why I'm running for governor.
So where would you cut taxes?
Well, first I would drive a stake. I would drive a nail, Cynthia, right through the legacy of the lost decade and the failed governorship of Jennifer Granholm. That income tax increase was supposed to have been temporary. It's never been rolled back. And so it's cost Michigan taxpayers $8 billion. And the fact is, you know, we need to cut taxes in Michigan just like President Trump cut taxes in America. That's why he's supporting me for governor, because he knows that I'll compliment and help him cut taxes here in the state of Michigan. And if we don't cut taxes, we won't be a growth state. You know, there are some of those who kind of view the world as a shrinking pie. I want us to expand the pie. And I'm not going to manage Michigan's decline, Cynthia. I want to encourage its growth, jobs, and how we win again.
But since that lost decade, I think it's safe to say the state of Michigan's in even greater disrepair than in the Granholm era, with roads worse and water infrastructure is worse. Many public school buildings are aging badly. So can you make up the revenue and yet meet these pressing needs?
Well, you know, it's the only way to go, because if we don't cut taxes, if we don't get more competitive, and if we don't win versus the other states, we'll be in slow decline. I'm not going to manage Michigan's decline. Think about the fact that 110 people move to Nashville, Tennessee every day to work and live. A 747 plane load of people arrive in Austin, Texas every day to work and live. Now, why did they do that? It's not because of the temperature. You know, it's 110 degrees there in July anyway. You know, you get it. It's the economic climate. We need to win and compete with the economic climate of more jobs and bigger paychecks. And my jobs and paychecks agenda is all about growing our population.
At this point, we don't know how much the Flint water crisis will cost the state. There's the lawsuit pending against the state for withholding billions of dollars of constitutional payments to local governments over the last couple of decades. And there are also signs that we could be headed into another economic downturn, perhaps even a full-blown recession, by the time the next governor of Michigan takes office. So how do you prepare for that possibility?
Well, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm Michigan's optimist, maybe America's optimist. But if your attitude is kind of the hand-wringing, shrinking pie that this Michigan's going to be smaller and smaller and other states are going to win and we're going to lose, that's not me. You know, elections are about choices and people get to choose. And my attitude is that our best days are ahead of us, not behind us. My attitude is that we need to cut taxes, cut auto insurance rates, give Michigan families a pay raise, and set an example that we're going to compete and win for jobs and investment and paychecks and win against the Carolinas and the Texases and the Floridas. And so I'm not going to settle for second place or just, okay, we're going to be in the middle of the pack. No way. We need to win. And that's the attitude I think will put Michigan in the right direction.
You have said you want to roll back the Medicaid expansion. So for the hundreds of thousands of Michiganders who managed to get themselves health insurance for perhaps the first time through Healthy Michigan, what would you do for them? What's there for them?
Well, you know, I think here's the issue. I think everybody knew it, but few talked about it. And the fact is the federal funds were not indefinite. And Mike Shirky and I are working together on putting a requirement in of work requirements for Medicaid. And so this is kind of has two facets to it, Cynthia. Number one, it's an important cultural requirement that you further reinforce the significance of work. And secondly, it would be a more efficient government and save the state and taxpayers money. So the Medicaid work requirement is an important element. Second, I think we had a block grant, whatever federal funds there are, to the states, and let the states be in charge of designing what the best healthcare plan is. Let Michigan make our decisions, not Washington. That's the fundamental approach. And you know, I fought Obamacare. My opponent supported expansion. I took Obamacare all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So there are differences in philosophy. And the Democrats, really, what the Democrats want, a single-payer system. And, you know, my father-in-law is 99 years old, World War II, POW fighter pilot. And, you know, this guy fought for his country so that we can have free expression here today. And when you think about how he's served and you think about the problems of the VA across the country, just points out the problems of a single-payer system. If you see what's going on in the VA, the last thing you'd want is a single-payer system across America.
I want to pivot over to the gun debate, particularly in light of the school shootings. We just had more headlines again a few days ago. How do you balance the need for public safety with Second Amendment rights?
These are fundamental points. And, you know, as a husband, as a father, you know, you first take your child by the hand and walk him or her to school or take him or her to school. And then later it's on the bus and you wave goodbye. Later, if they get their license and they may drive to school. But each time in the whole, as children grow up, you want them to come home safely. And every parent's worst nightmare is when there's a problem at a school. And we've seen the tragedy in Santa Fe High School or Parkland. And obviously there is a mental health crisis in America, and we need to have greater treatment. And the young crews individual in Florida. There were so many alerts that went unnoticed, and he wasn't helped at all. And that's a great tragedy, and the consequences of that were just so tragic as well. And the point is, we have a mental health crisis. Second, we need to have more programs like OK to Say, which is Michigan School Safety Initiative that I put into place as Attorney General, where it's a 24/7, 365. If you have received a tip that someone might cause harm to himself or herself, bring a gun to school, cause violence, that you can send an email or a text or a phone number, and then the closest first responder will be notified to try to stop violence before it occurs. And this is this was a homegrown issue from Cadillac, Michigan, from a superintendent who came to my office and some legislators, and we put it into place. And so school safety initiative is important. And then thirdly, we have to have greater security in our schools. And I think that means, Cynthia, that certain teachers, not everyone, be very careful with my words here, some teachers ought to have the ability to provide security and safety in their schools, properly trained and annual review. But it's security, it's a school safety initiative like OK to Say, and it's about treating the challenges of mental illness.
And is there no room for gun law reform at all in your view? Background checks, assault weapon ban?
Well, you know, I think there are Senator Cornyn in Texas is a Republican leader in the United States Senate was working on some instant background checks. We'll see how that develops. The real point is let's have a discussion in this country about mental health and how do you treat mental illness and make sure we have greater, you know, we go to airports all the time and those airports are secure. Why shouldn't our places of learning also have security? I think they should.
As you've referenced through our conversation and certainly prior to that, you're very full-throated in your support for President Donald Trump.
Yep.
So my question is, what have the voters—
Did I tell you that he endorsed my candidacy for governor?
Yes, we do know that.
Okay, I just want to make
General.
Sure. Not anybody else. And he knows who was with him and who jumped ship. You know, I've talked to the president in the White House about my race, and he knows those who renounced his their support, who jumped ship, didn't help. And all that did, just think what would happen if Hillary Clinton had won. We wouldn't have had Gorsuch in the United States Supreme Court. We wouldn't have tax cuts. And now the Ram trucks is going to be moved from Mexico to Michigan. And every Chrysler Automotive worker is getting a $2,000 Trump tax cut bonus. I'm glad I helped beat Hillary Clinton and made sure Donald Trump was president.
Well, let me ask you about the voters throughout Michigan who are afraid or angered or appalled because of actions and tweets and positions from this president. Should you become the Republican Party nominee, how would you go about winning the support of people who are deeply concerned about President Trump's leadership?
You know, I think like any election, the elections are about choices. And I'm going to be Michigan's jobs governor. And I have a jobs and paychecks package so that we have a plan that will have more jobs and bigger paychecks in Michigan. And I think that's what Donald Trump is about. And he's supporting my candidacy because he knows I'm going to cut taxes just in Michigan like he cut taxes in America. And, you know, I think people in this state want jobs. They want paychecks. And that's what drove the victory in 2016 for Donald Trump. And it's going to help me win in 2018.
Mr. Schutte, was Rick Snyder a good governor for Michigan?
You know, I enjoy Rick Snyder. He's got a great family, and we've rebounded. We've rebounded through, and we were flat on the mat. We were on life support after the failed governorship of Jennifer Granholm. And so we've rebounded, and thanks to our Republican team, leaders in the House and the Senate, the governor, we've all been part of this team. But now we need to make sure we go from good to great. And now it's about, we're still 300,000 jobs short. 300,000 jobs short of where we were after the Great Recession of 2007 and 8. And if we keep on our rate of growth, it's barely a flat. And so that means that other states will be winning. Other states will be having more jobs and more paychecks. We need to make sure we win again. And that means we got to cut taxes and cut insurance rates. And that's what it's about. It's about the future.
State Attorney General Bill Schutte, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Great to be with you, Cynthia. Thank you. Hope to do it again.
Stateside reached out to the Cali campaign with a request for an interview. The response was, and I'm quoting, "I think we are planning to do this, but aren't able to nail down a date and time just yet." indulge us for a moment here, because we need to say goodbye. From the very first moment stateside began in August 2012, Allie Billings was there. Her heart and soul have been all over these programs through the years, finding stories, lining up the best guests, editing interviews with a perfect touch, directing shows with a calm and steady hand, greeting you when we've been on the road. Because producing a daily show really does demand 1,000 different things, and usually all at the same time. But today is Allie's last show as she heads to Brooklyn to get married and build a new life with her fiancé, Alex. Ann Arbor's loss is Brooklyn's gain. Stateside is going to miss you, Allie Billings. Thank you for all that you've done to make Stateside the show it is. Do not be a stranger. So for the final time, today's program was directed by Allie Billings. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.